This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here for today's interview episode with David Canfield.
Hi, Katie.
And Chris Murphy.
Hello, hello.
Chris, you've been on so much lately. We're so delighted to have you.
People are going to get sick of me, but they can't keep me away from this mic.
Absolutely.
It's never. Pride Month. They can't keep
you away. You guys have the interviews for today's episode. David, let's start with you and your conversation with Bryan Cranston, who is not only a television icon who is part of the Emmy conversation this year, but he's also in Wes Anderson's new movie, Asteroid City. I love the range of what he's got going on lately, and it sounds like he does too.
He does. We also got to talk a little bit about Better Call Saul. He is somehow still eligible for an Emmy for playing Walter White. It's got to be one of the longest runs ever in that regard. But yeah, Asteroid City is a really interesting project for him. He was one of the main voices in Isle of Dogs, but this was his first live action Wes Anderson movie. He gets to play a kind of narrator role, which for people who love Wes Anderson movies know that that is uniquely demanding and idiosyncratic kind of part, and he kind of nails it, unsurprisingly. And there's a lot of, you know, mechanics that go into that and prep, and it's unlike anything else that he's done, really.
And he's done such a wide range of things also. Like, I mean, I kind of got to listen in on your conversation and kind of the joy he takes in stretching himself and in finding new things to do. It's really nice to see for someone who, you know, could really just comfortably lean into something easy at this point in his career.
Yeah, he seems like he never takes it for granted. And there was a bit of a full circle element to the conversation and to this moment for him, because he's quite aware that coming off of Breaking Bad, that's where all of his opportunities have come from. You know, he's won 2 Tonys, he's been an Oscar nominee, and he's now working with people like Wes Anderson. And so he sees himself on a Wes Anderson set, while also still bringing Walter White back to life in these different incarnations. He also did a Super Bowl commercial that we talked briefly about. And there's this feeling of, you can draw a line from Breaking Bad to all this stuff that he's gotten to do and hopes to continue to do.
Yeah. Well, let's hear all about it in your conversation with Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston, thanks for joining us. We've got a lot to get into. I feel like, as always with you, you're always a busy guy.
Well, aren't we all busy, Dave? Come
on. I'd like to think so. However, not all of us are just fresh from Cannes, which I believe you are.
Yes, yeah. What an experience that is.
Yeah, especially when you're with a Wes Anderson movie, because I'm always fascinated by, you know, the photo calls you guys get to do with just this immense glamour behind you and all of these unbelievable actors just sort of lined up. What was the experience like?
And every single one of those actors are saying to themselves, I'm going to be glad when this is over and I can get out of this tuxedo or this dress and these high heels and just, you know, get into sweats and have a glass of wine. That's what everybody was saying.
I'm not surprised by that. It does look, it looks pretty intense.
It is. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance to it, but I'm glad. I'm glad it brings attention to the cinema and theatrical storytelling that is coming soon and get everybody excited about it.
Yeah, let's start by talking about Asteroid City a little bit. It's a beautiful little movie, and it's one that I believe it's the first time you've done a live action film with Wes, right?
It is. Yes. I did Isle of Dogs with him a few years ago, and that was an animated film.
You play a kind of role in his movies that I find particularly fascinating, which is the kind of narrator role. It's not like narrator roles in other Wes Anderson, in other movies. Wes Anderson narrators have a lot of action going on behind them. There's a particular tone to it. I love the one Bob Balaban did, for instance, in Moonrise Kingdom.
Yes.
How do you figure that kind of role out? It's a weird one.
It is a weird one. Wes makes an animatic of the entire movie and voices all the characters and gives that what he calls a cartoon to the actors on a laptop. And we watch it and we realize, oh, okay, that's the tone he's going for. That's what he meant in that, on that page. That was kind of difficult to understand. He's so specific and so pure in his thinking and individual that you can't predict how he is going to do any one thing. So you just have to be there and be ready to experience it and adapt and be flexible. In my character in Asteroid City, actually the whole thing is about it's a movie about a television show that is doing an expose on a theatrical piece.
Right.
And I play the host of the television show that is doing the introduction. So there's a tremendous amount of expositional information that needs to get out and introductions. I introduce almost every character.
Yep.
And also, you know, try to keep the audience aware of the plot points. And in order to do that, I wanted to be like a journalist where you are not infusing your performance with emotion. Mm-hmm. Or inflection. I wanted to kind of be a little deadpan and droll and just get out the information, let the audience hear it, and then watch the play unfold. So it was fun, though. I mean, it was fun and challenging at the same time.
Yeah. In each of his films, especially those more recently, there's so much going on. Most of the actors are not necessarily working with each other. And you mentioned the nesting doll kind of conceit of this one. How did the script and the story strike you overall, even, you know, beyond your involvement in it? What did you connect to in it?
You know, Wes has a legacy of his films that he always takes big chances. Mm-hmm. He always does something very unique. It's not something where you see other filmmakers doing. They have their own individuality. So like an actor's experience in the first acting class one has ever taken, you just embrace the trust exercise that goes with it. You give over, you let go. Instead of going into a Wes Anderson movie going, all right, here's what I want to do and what I'm going to do and here's how I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. You just let go of all that preconceived ideas and the way you approach other films, and you just fall back and get into the flow of that odd sensibility that he has and just flow with it and be part of the company. And that's what it really is. There are no hierarchy in a Wes Anderson movie. There's no call sheet. There's no, I'm number one on the call sheet, I'm number two, you're number seven. There are no dressing rooms. There are no trailers. Everyone is all together. We live together. We eat together. We recreate together. It's really a great experience from that standpoint that actors have this opportunity to go to what I was calling actor camp. it's really fun.
Yeah. It feels that way when you watch it. It's very obvious, I think, watching a movie like this that there is no hierarchy, but I am curious, coming in as a relative newbie, you know, if Wes is giving a kind of direction, maybe, do you see Jason Schwartzman, you know, laughing at the fact that he's been working with him for 20 years and knows his tics maybe a little bit? Like, are there kinds of, there's a kind of awareness maybe of some of the people there who know him pretty well.
We know him pretty well, and we're all at the same table every night for dinner.
Yeah.
So there's Bob Balaban, and there's Jeff Goldblum, and Ed Norton, and Bill Murray, and Jason Schwartzman, and we're all there, Adrian Brody, and we're all discussing, you know, what you have to do. And it was a relief to have us being able to talk openly over glasses of wine and food and say, yeah, I'm nervous about this and that and the other, and other people going, me too. Yeah, I was too. You know, something that you wouldn't just open up and say to the press or to the public. Mm-hmm. It is very insular to be able to wrap your arms around this company and have an experience within this company that is pretty extraordinary and very unique to filmmaking.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. In terms of films generally, I saw you had written a really lovely post about your film, The One and Only Ivan, recently.
Oh.
That is, I think it's off Disney Plus now, or it's soon leaving. In terms of making movies right now, and particularly ones that go to streaming, how did you experience that whole news cycle of this movie you made that clearly you felt a great deal about, kind of getting yanked off the service?
I don't pretend to get involved in any of the business end of it. I truly am grateful that Disney made the movie and that we were able to tell that story. And wherever the one and only Ivan winds up, you know, in the ether world that we live in, it may be a challenge for people to find it, but, you know, with some effort, they'll be able to do that. The marriage of business and creativity has always been a strange bedfellow. We have a symbiotic relationship. We both need each other. Mm-hmm. The business end needs the creative content. The creators need the finances for the support and the infrastructure that the business, such as Disney and Disney Channel or Disney Plus, has to be able to go. So, for example, The One and Only Ivan was supposed to be a theatrical release.
Right.
And all of a sudden, through the act of God, and in this case, COVID and the horrible experience that the world went through, it shut everything down. Nobody was going anywhere. And Disney pivoted and put it on Disney Plus, where it found an audience. And it was like, how fortunate to be able to say, oh, it would have been horrible if it just, you know, lingered on a shelf somewhere and didn't find distribution. And you know, so it the timing of it seemed to work out well. And I think it worked fine in the small screen, too. I don't think that The One and Only Ivan was a must-see on the large screen. I think it worked really well on Disney Channel.
Yeah, and you had another film hit streaming this past season, Jerry and Marge Go Large. Paramount Plus. Yeah. So yeah, you've been in the streaming game a little bit.
That's another one that they said, well, we think this is going to go on Paramount Plus. And I said, okay. You know, again, there are other people whose job it is to determine where something is best placed. That's not my job. My job is just to focus on doing the best one I can in creating and telling these stories. And then you have to release it. You have to let that go. And so that's what we did. And I think it played really well on Paramount Plus. I think that too was a great home for it. And very grateful that we were able to find a home for that.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Well, let me ask you about the intersection of business and creativity with a project like Your Honor, because I think it's an interesting question with that show, because I believe it was conceived as a limited series. It was a big hit for Showtime. What was the balance for you between the network probably wanting it to come back because it was successful and you wanting to do it again?
When we were initially discussing this with Peter Moffat, the creator showrunner of the show, he pitched it as a two-season concept. And while that made sense, I was really fixated on the structure that Big Little Lies had, which was that one season, it was intended to be one season.
Yep.
Beginning, middle, and end. And I that's what it excited me. And so I only signed up for 1 year. And we did the 1 year, first season of Your Honor. And I was happy with it. It ended in a tragic way, but appropriately. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it came to a very satisfying conclusion for the story we were telling. And then Peter came to me and said, not that you're going to or have to, but what would you say, where is Michael Desiato? And I said, I think he either took his own life because he lost everything in the world, or he's in prison for the crimes he committed. So he pitched an idea. He went away and then came back and pitched an idea where my character would be in prison. And I made some adjustments to that, which he liked. So the two of us were on our way to create this third season. And we pitched Showtime with the idea that here's a story of redemption, of a person working through grief and despair. And if you're willing to do that, I'm very interested in telling that story. So that's where it went. And Showtime, to their credit, they said, let's do it. We love that. And I said, you know, I promise you it won't be maudlin. I promise you it won't bring the audience down. We're still going to have plenty of action and activity around Michael, but Michael himself is not going to be the catalyst to a lot of things going on because of his honest place in circumstantial life that he's had. And so they said, let's do it. And we were all very pleased with that as well. So here you have an example of a home with Showtime or with Paramount Plus or with Disney Channel, Disney Plus. I'm just grateful that we have these platforms now that everybody around the world is accustomed to and knows that's where they can go to find really well-told stories.
Yeah. One way in which Your Honor reminded me of a past show you did, a little one called Breaking Bad, is that in both you get to chart this pretty extreme, extraordinary physical transformation and show how that reflects the character's transformation. What do you gain from those kinds of evolutions in a character, and particularly the kind that television, I think, uniquely affords?
Well, I think what you mean by what television affords is the expanse of time.
Yes.
As, yeah. Well, I've always said that Breaking Bad would have made a terrible movie, mm-hmm. because you would have had to truncate the stories and skip over a lot of development, the slow descent of this man into where he was, and you'd have to get to that end. And it's the journey that counts. And I think that's why television now, whether it's Breaking Bad or Your Honor or Succession, whatever the case may be, we invest. Audiences invest time and energy. And once a week, which I like better than binging, the once a week allows the audience to delay their gratification, to have show some restraint. And also it develops, you know, interest and in that conversation about, oh, can you imagine what's going to happen next week? And it really gets people excited. So I like that format. But I've always thought that the story should dictate the medium. You know, there are sketches on Saturday Night Live that are 3 to 5 minutes long, and they're perfect for that. It's like a nugget. It's great, and they've been doing it for, you know, decades. Where that might go wrong sometimes is thinking that you can take that 3 to 5 minute and now let's make a feature film out of this. And it's like, it wasn't designed for that. You have to be very careful about how that becomes the next yes. iteration. So the story should dictate that. And whether it's a one season or two season or a 90 minute or 2 hour movie, it depends on the story itself.
Yeah. At the same time, you're an actor who a lot of your characters have lived pretty long lives, even some of your stage characters, like, you know, Network or All the Way. You've played those characters in multiple iterations. Do you find it hard sometimes to say goodbye to them? I mean, you just did a Super Bowl commercial to keep Walter White alive.
You know, the Popcorners commercial that Aaron Paul and I did, at first, it's like, we want you to do that. And I go, well, I don't know. What is it you want? And they pitched us the idea. And Aaron and I talked about it. And we said, when we were doing the show for those 7 years, there weren't a lot of times that we were actually having fun and laughing during the process.
Yes.
It was a very serious show. And so, at a very draining and demanding show. I said, would it be fun if we can get everybody back together and just have fun and laugh and goof around? And that's why we wanted to do it. Vince Gilligan directed it. We had the camera people and wardrobe and makeup. They were all from Breaking Bad. And so we were able to reunite a lot of people into doing. So a lot of it is experiential, you know, like we were talking about Wes Anderson. I want to have a good experience as well as a good outcome from the story you tell. You know, the All the Way that I did on Broadway about Lyndon Johnson in the year after President Kennedy was assassinated, HBO came to us and they said we'd love to do this and the package came together with Jay Roach directing, and I couldn't pass that up. I worked with Jay Roach also on Trumbo, and so I love the guy and love to spend time with him, and he's so creative. And so it's those kind of combinations that you look for when you're talking about doing a performance. Network was the same way. Ivo van Hove is an auteur himself, a theatrical director, and I just gave in. He's a lot like Wes Anderson in that you let go and just go with the flow of what Ivo wants to go, and you allow yourself to flow with it.
Yeah. Do you find, as you continue on in these various characters, new layers? Like, let's take Better Call Saul for an example. For which you are remarkably still Emmy eligible to playing Walter White. That's quite a long run in that regard.
Crazy.
But, you know, you did get some, it's an interesting little storyline you got there. What is it like to step back into those shoes in again, a dramatic context as part of this expansive show?
You know, when we left Breaking Bad, which was 10 years ago, 10 years ago, we stopped shooting Breaking Bad. And for all intents and purposes, I thought, well, that was a great run. That's the end of that. Move on. And then there was, well, it's not quite done. There was El Camino to do. Oh, yeah, that'd be great. Tell the story. What happened to Jesse Pinkman? Okay. And then Better Call Saul kicked in and it was like, oh, well, okay, we might come back and do it. You know, okay. And then there's the commercial. And so I'm in the never say never category on that sort of thing. Do I think Walter White will ever come back? I don't think so, but I could be wrong. And it was, you know, it was like going to a high school reunion when you go back and do these things, familiar faces, familiar costume. You feel like you're back in high school. We felt like, oh my God, here we are again. We're doing this. It's just, it's kind of amazing. And it was also a touchstone to an incredibly important period of my life, mm-hmm. and one that I celebrate and recognize as it was a career-changing experience, and in so doing, it changed my life as well.
Yeah. In some ways, you can draw a line right from that to Wes Anderson.
In some ways.
Yeah. Well, in the spirit of not quite saying goodbye, I have heard that with Your Honor, you have not felt ready to say goodbye quite yet, or put the pin in it. You could see yourself continuing to do it?
If there is a good reason to do it, to be perfectly honest, Dave, I don't need a job. I don't want a job. I love to work, but it has to be a good reason. If a good story was connected, like this, the story of the second season of Your Honor really got to me, because it was like, okay, yes, if a man loses his soul, compromises his ethics, and ends up losing everything anyway, what happens to that man? Where does he go? Where's redemption? Is forgiveness part of that equation? Can he forgive himself? What does happen to a person who experienced grave despair? So that was something worth exploring. If there was something impactful like that again, that was proposed for season 3 of Your Honor, I would very much entertain it. But I just don't know what that is yet.
Yeah. Coming off of a film like Asteroid City and working with a director like Wes Anderson, do you have another director who's pretty high on your list that you'd love to work with?
Oh, there's several. And I hasten to mention any names, because then I know I'm going to forget someone of great importance. But yes, what happens if you're fortunate enough to get active work? You are subjected to better and better pool of talented people. And I want to be open and ready and available for that to happen. So it's been a great ride so far. And, you know, I love going back and forth between film or television or theater. And I just keep in the mix that way. I want to surprise my fans and my audience, and in so doing, I surprise myself often about some of the things that I've selected.
Is there anything recently that felt particularly surprising to you?
Yeah, well, there's something coming up that is surprising. It's something I've never done before.
Okay.
and it scares me. And it's in the works. It's going to happen in the year 2025. And so there's a lot of preparation in order to get to that point. And, you know, that's part of it, is to not be able to just stay in a comfort zone, but to, in my case, I don't have to force myself into a position of discomfort. I'm kind of attracted to it like an open flame, but I want to do it smartly. And you know, I do have pride in my work. When I do something that is not normally in my wheelhouse, I want to have the time to prepare myself to do it very well. Otherwise, I would be disappointed in myself.
I'm excited for this Mystery 2025.
Mystery 2025. Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't know when we're going to announce that. That maybe even later this year.
Well, I wish you all the best of luck with whatever it may be. And thank you very much for your time.
I'll keep
Brian
that
Branson.
Mystery, Dave.
Please do. We like a little mystery on this.
We like a little mystery.
Okay, Chris, you got to talk to Molly Shannon, who is also a TV industry veteran who has also done a million different things and also is kind of challenging herself as part of a very new kind of comedy compared to maybe SNL of the 90s on the other two.
Yeah, we actually talked about the span of her career from, you know, her breakout turn on SNL and, you know, Mary Catherine Gallagher and Terry Rialto and Sally O'Malley and all those amazing characters. And now her newest iconic character, Pat Dubek, on The Other Two, in this really hilarious, really absurd season three, talking a lot with Molly about specifically episode 7, where Pat Dubek is trapped in a fake Applebee's, which sounds crazy, but really makes sense once you see the episode. And we really spent a lot of time talking about how Molly Shannon is so great at sort of balancing absurd comic, like heightened situations, and grounding it in reality and bringing an emotional depth to things that are as silly and as crazy as being trapped in an Applebee's. And she was an absolute delight and gave some secrets about how she finds the rhythm of comedic beats and how she, you know, is so great at setting up punchlines and sort of the music of comedy, if you will.
David, I know you're a fan of The Other Two as well, and it feels like it's flown under the radar, but maybe is getting a little bit more recognition now. Maybe is Molly Shannon finally getting some of her due for what she's been doing on the show?
I think so. I rewatched the entire series a couple weeks ago after I ran out of season 3 screeners. And one of the genius strokes of this show was the way it gave her a bigger part. You know, in the first season, she's very much like the mom to this sudden child superstar, but then she becomes a superstar midway into the show's run and starts to loom larger in the main characters' lives in a way that is hilarious and poignant, as Chris was saying. And she just completely nails it. So I can't wait to listen.
Yeah, Chris, let's hear your conversation with Molly Shannon.
Your work on this season of The Other Two is absolutely incredible.
Oh my God, thank you.
So I gotta know, you know, as a uber fan of the show, in season 2, Pat Dubek, who you play wonderfully, she sort of becomes Ellen. And then in season 3, she kind of transforms into Oprah, like the most famous woman on the planet.
Exactly, yes.
Were you prepared for that arc? Can you tell me about like that evolution from, you know, from just a mom to then to a talk show host to then owner of a network?
I wasn't prepared. I have total trust in Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider, our brilliant showrunners. I don't even ask them. I just wait till the scripts come out and then I'm just excited and surprised. They are just so talented. So I've never played a character like that before ever in my life. Like somebody that rich with beautiful clothes and a giant house and a screening room. And yeah. So it was really fun. It was just a total surprise to see that turn, because she starts off as like a mother moving to New York City from Ohio, a very almost like a Kate Gosselin, you know.
Yes.
Very Midwestern mom type, you know, bringing her son to New York City to make it big. And then she's really changed and grown. And so it was so fun to play.
Yeah. I mean, she really starts off, you know, a single mom who loves her kids, who works 2 jobs and never stops, to quote the Reba song. I mean, you have so many jobs by season 3. And I have to wonder, I mean, because you've been in the industry for so long and you've been famous for many years now. Is fame really a prison? Like, is it really as much of a prison as as
that's
the show?
That's so funny. No, not at all. I'm a very outgoing person. And so I really love to talk to people, and you meet so many strangers. People come up to you. So no, I love it. I guess if you were like a very introverted person and you got really famous, that probably would be hard, but I'm extroverted, so I get energy from that. But I think when having kids was hard, like when they were little, because I would go about my normal day as a mom and you're kind of like double duty, like hi to the fans and taking care of your kids. So that part's a little harder.
Yeah.
But no, it doesn't feel like a prison at all. But sometimes people will go like, hi, Molly. Like they know me. And yeah. I'm like, do I know you? And all that kind of friendly. And then they're like, no, you don't know me. So that part's a little weird. I remember when I first started Saturday Night Live, they would kind of recognize me. And then Adam Sandler told me, because he had been on the show before me and we had gone to NYU Drama School together, he goes, just wait. He goes, soon they're going to know your name. They'll call out Molly. And I couldn't believe it. And then that did happen, of course. But no, yeah. It's really not a problem.
Wow. I mean, that's because I was worried. I mean, Pat this season, she just wants to go on a walk. She just wants to, you know, eat dinner at Applebee's, right? It's such a simple request that for, you know, someone of that magnitude. And I think what the other two does so well, you know, as somebody, you know, in the industry or who writes about the industry, is it gets at how the sort of the intricacies and nuances of the entertainment industry and how these simple tasks like going for a walk, going to get brunch with your kids, or just having dinner at Applebee's can be incredibly hard and absurd when you're at a certain level of fame.
Exactly. Well, she has like alien level fame, like, right, like Oprah fame. There's fame, then there's like alien level, like the superstars. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so it is hard for her to just do a normal thing, like go to Applebee's and have dinner with her family without being bothered. So she feels like, she feels lonely and a little disillusioned, like not knowing that this is what it would be like, you know?
Yeah, I love that. And that loneliness, I mean, in that episode, it's episode 7, where you sort of have a breakdown at Applebee's, and you're so fantastic. I mean, in season 2, you sort of, you know, the end of the season ends with Pat, you know, in the hospital because she's so overexerted and she's worked so hard. And then we get to season 3, and in episode 7, you know, you also have a breakdown because everyone around you is lying to you and making it seem like you're at this, you know, normal restaurant when really it's a big elaborate smoke and mirrors operation. Can you talk to me a little bit about filming that and having to sort of pretend that you don't know what's happening, but you also know what's happening because you're acting, you have the whole script. Can you walk me through what that episode was like?
So I always wanted to be in a horror movie. I told Chris Kelly, and he was like, this is it, baby. So it felt like it felt crazy to shoot too, because in all honesty, there's all these extras and I have to perform with them and they got a kick out of it, believe me.
Yeah.
Because I'm a very spontaneous performer and I like to play around with the other performers and really use the room and improvise a little bit within the parameters of the script, of course.
Totally.
But it felt surreal. It felt like we were in an Applebee's because they recreated the set so perfectly.
Wow, that's so cool.
It was crazy. And so shooting it, you know how you say it was like meta, like this on top of this on top of this? That's what it felt like shooting it, because it was so strange being in this Applebee's. It's a sound stage that we were in, but it felt like we were in an actual Applebee's. So
yeah,
I felt the way the character felt, but it was just really fun to shoot and very technical because you have to do it all in like pieces and but it was really fun. I just love the way they write, and it's so like it's crazy and scary, and then it's emotional and she's like heartbroken, and it's just the most challenging as an actor to play, you know?
Totally. Yeah. And you also got to date Simu Liu, not terrible.
I know, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I got to say, one of my favorite things about the other two performances, but also, and I love that for you, which I loved, you with Jackie, is that both of these shows have sort of an absurdist quality. They're sort of hyper, you know, realistic. And yet you find a way to absolutely hit all the comedic moments, of course, but you find a way of really grounding these characters in the reality of their situations, even if that situation is as absurd as I am at dinner with my family, but they've created a whole soundstage and I'm piecing it together. So as an actor, like how cognizant of you about sort of balancing the humor and the absurdity of these situations, but also like grounding it in like a really real and relatable place?
I really think that the comedy plays better when it's emotionally truthful. It's funnier. It lands more because it feels genuine. So I treat it just like a very serious dramatic scene, like an actress, as if I was doing Shakespeare. You know, I really do. But then I've been in show business for a long time, and I love when there's an excellent joke written that I make sure I hit that joke with comic timing, you know, like because I appreciate the writing so much. So I know when there's a joke, like if there's a crazy joke, like I will hit that joke and make sure you can hear that joke in a very technical way. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes a ton of sense. And it feels like that is such a, like you have to be operating on both sides of your brain because you have to be in the moment and being grounded, but you also have to be prepared for like, I better not mess up this punchline when it comes.
Exactly, exactly. Conan O'Brien said a great thing once. He said that all, you know, comedy is like music, that there's a rhythm to it, how it builds and then releases. And he said that most comedians are also musical. And I think that's really true.
Wow. Wow. Would you consider yourself musical? I mean...
Yes, absolutely. I love music. And when I think of the way a monologue works, whether it was the end of season two of like, da, 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 or this, not to give anything away, but I won't, of like pleading, you know, the jokes, I think of it like an orchestra, you know what I mean? Like conducting, like the way it comes out. I'm thinking of it with a beat. Does that make sense? Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah.
No, it really does. And you can feel it as an audience member watching it. And I do think part of that musicality and part of what makes the ensembles that you've been a part of from the other two to I Love That For You to The White Lotus season one, which I'm definitely going to circle back to, is it feels like an ensemble of everyone sort of playing their own instruments, but they all work together to create this symphony of either comedy or drama when it needs to be.
Exactly. But make no mistake, it's just like Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider. Oh, boy, do I feel lucky, Chris. You don't know. They're such good writers and they really know how to write specifically for people. And not everybody knows how to do that. They really know how to adjust to each person and what their strengths are and kind of the rhythm of how they talk. They can really find that and they'll use parts of the real person with the character to make it. So it ends up feeling very natural. It fits like a glove the way they write it. And that is not always the case. So it's such a pleasure to perform because Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider are such gifted writer, showrunner, creators.
They really are.
They are.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
I would love to know, because there was a bit of a gap between season two and season three because of the pandemic and filming and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you were obviously busy in that time frame and probably stepped away from the character. What was it like stepping back into the role after sort of a few months, you know, over a year away? Mm-hmm. Did it fit like an old glove? Did you have to like find her again? Did you discover new things about Pat?
Yeah, I think it fit like an old glove. But you know what was so interesting, Chris, is that Chris Kelly said, you know, Pat does speak differently. She's come into her power. Mm-hmm. She's gotten more sophisticated about show business and savvy. So she's changed, you know. She has a new romance.
Yeah.
So she speaks differently. So that part was, you hear her saying different things. If you know what I'm talking
totally.
About.
Totally, yeah.
Like
yeah.
when she's texting and it's like, whoa, Pat.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that felt a little bit different. I had to get that right. But they're just so good. If say, I don't get it right, they will really guide me to getting it right.
It feels like a lot of things that are billed as comedy, while there are funny moments, there aren't actually jokes written into the script and people just perform really well or they're just naturally kind of funny or charismatic. Whereas the other two, which is, I think, important in light of the writer's strike, the jokes are stacked. It's like stacked with jokes.
Yes.
Do you feel that in terms of scripts that you see or scripts that you get sent, that there's a difference?
Yes. Well, I just, again, Chris Kelly, Sarah Schneider, they are just so talented. It's like putting together a puzzle, the way everything's set up and paid off and all the different characters and the distinct voices. You know, yeah. I think sometimes what you'll get is people that can write, you know, funny stuff, but they won't really know how to write characters, specific characters. And they're so good that they'll write jokes specifically for those characters. Sometimes people will just write general stuff that anyone could say. It kind of all merges together. It's like, oh, that character could say it, or that, or that. But these jokes are for, like, jokes that only Pat would say, or that Carrie would say. You know what I mean? That is very good writing, you know?
Yes. No, and that's, it totally is a cut above, and I think it's, you know, with, you know, everything that's going on with writers right now, it's like, it has to be mentioned that it's really, I don't think AI could write the other two scripts, you know?
Exactly. Isn't that crazy, thinking about AI writing a script? Oh my God.
It's very scary, and it is very disconcerting. And I think this is a perfect show that encapsulates the importance of having human voices and talented humans collaborating to create, you know, a really wonderful comedy and work of art. Do you watch the shows, like, now that, you know, you've been on TV for so long, like, do you watch the shows that you're in? Like,
That's so funny, Chris. I have never seen the end of season two. Like, I think I only saw the first five episodes because I don't love to watch myself because I don't like thinking about what I look like when I perform. Yeah. I don't ever want to be self-conscious, and I don't want to be worried if I look a little older. I don't want to be thinking about that. I want to feel free. So, but I actually do want to go back and watch the end of season two before I start watching season three. So maybe I will go and watch it. Yeah. But I'm like, I sometimes just don't watch at all.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
I mean, I totally understand that. But I will say, you're in for a treat because you do some great work.
Maybe I'll see it. But it was really fun wearing the old age makeup. It was so fun because Louis from Saturday Night Live came and did my makeup with his team. And it was so fun, like, walking around Brooklyn when we were shooting with that old age makeup. I went and bought a sandwich, and the guy was like, really, like, ignored me. And I'm used to being treated, getting recognized, you know. I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I called my niece. I FaceTimed my niece, and she was in hysterics because I look completely different.
Completely.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, I wish I should, like, meet someone for lunch and just surprise them, you know? Like, there were just so many tricks I could play on people. And there was one morning where I saw Ken Marino, but I forgot I had the old lady prosthetic stuff on. And so I waved to Ken to say good morning, and he just kind of ignored me. And I was like, that's weird, Ken, maybe he's distracted. And then I was following behind him, and I, like, waved again, and he kind of looked and was, like, rude and just kind of ignored me and walked ahead of me. Then Ken goes into the set, and then I come into the set. He's like, there's that woman again. Like, who is this lady? And then he realized it was me, and we were in hysterics.
Oh my God. That is the power. Yeah. That is the power of good makeup. Yeah. That is the power of craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. I love that you just brought up SNL because, you know, you recently went back to your old stomping grounds and hosted a wonderful episode.
Thank you.
You got to tell me, what was that like to sort of, you know, come back to the place where it all began in a way?
It was everything I would have ever dreamed of. It was just so great being back with Lorne Michaels. It was just so great working with him and, like, having him give me advice, because he's a legend. And it just felt so fun. Steve Higgins and all this amazing new cast and writers. I have to tell you, Chris, I was so nervous though.
No.
But yes, because I was like, oh my God, are fans expecting me to do all my old characters? But then I just wanted to have fun with the cast and do what they wrote. So I started to get really nervous. And then so I was nervous, more nervous than I've ever been. But it was, I had the best time. And you know what? As soon as I finished, I felt like, God, I could go back and do it again. It's like a muscle that you haven't worked out for a while. And I forget how hard it is because it's live performance and you have to write and get your own stuff on. But once I did it, I was like, oh God, I miss it. I really miss doing the show. I could just go back and do Saturday Night Live in all honesty.
I mean, we would love that. I mean,
I loved it. It made me hungry to do more, you know?
live live stage performance even? Like, would you, you know,
well,
a play?
I would love to go back and do something else. It's like a little bit of pressure when you're the host, because I get like, oh, I want to please everybody and give them the show they want. But, you know, you're just going to do what's written and stuff. And I worked on a few things on my own that I brought myself. But for the most part, I just wanted to work with the cast and the writers. And but I was going to say... But yes, I would love to go back. And this new cast is so fantastic. And I'm so glad I got to do it before the writer's strike.
I know. That's really crazy. I mean, the timing really is incredible, because right now, there, you know, while we're recording this, we should say there are no SNL episodes that are happening.
I know.
Because of the writer's strike.
Yeah. And then, Chris, also what was so special was my husband and kids came, and my niece and nephew, but having my two children there, Stella and Nolan, they came when they were really little, but they'd never really seen it. Like, as now they're older, my son's in high school, my daughter's a freshman in college, they got to see, you know, the place where I got famous, most well-known, and see how it all works. So it's kind of like they got to see me the way the public sees me, maybe for the first time or something. It was just, that was the most special part of it.
That's really fantastic. That, and I guess I do want to know, because so many people love to, you know, are nostalgic for the past in comedy. And it's like, I remember growing up and like, you know, my prime time, you know, SNL was, you know, like you leading into then Maya Rudolph and Tina Fey and Amy and whatnot. And then Kristen Wiig. And it feels like comedy is sort of always changing with different eras. And you sort of are a testament to, I mean, you've been funny since day one and you're still making current comedy with this sort of new generation. Do you feel that comedy has changed drastically since, you know, your early SNL days, or?
That's so interesting. Well, yes, probably. I think there are stuff, there are stories that maybe I used to be able to tell on talk shows that you just can't. It's a different time now.
Totally.
So I think, yes, it probably has changed. Yes, absolutely. I think, yes.
Has your approach to comedy changed, do you think, since?
No, not really. It's just like if I give, like I give a commencement address at NYU for all the whole Tisch School of the Arts at Radio
City. That's your alma mater, right?
Yes, that's my alma mater. And, you know, there are certain jokes where I'm like, oh, can we tell that? Ah, we better not. You should be a little more careful. It's a different time.
Yeah. But for your, the way that you, you know, but you're still approaching, you know, from the first time you did Mary Catherine Gallagher to now, your approach is still completely, this is still the same. You're still approaching
them. It's still the same. Exactly. It's still the same. Yes. I feel it's still the same. Yes. Still the same.
I love that. I do want to know, is there anything that you feel you haven't gotten to show of yourself? Is there anything you're still really wanting to do or perform that might be a side that we haven't seen from Molly Shannon yet?
That's so great. Yeah, I'm sure. I feel like I have such great relationships with people who I collaborate with, so I want to keep working with the same people. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, I would love to work with somebody new. I love writer-directors. And so I just feel open. But I did tell Chris Kelly that I would like to do a horror movie. really good. Wouldn't that be great?
That would be absolutely the wildest thing you could do. And I would be front row.
Great. Or it could be funny and scary. I want to put it out there, Chris.
They say that horror and comedy are really sort of similar, right? There, you have to really sort of be in the moment, and there's a thin line, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see. But I feel grateful for all the opportunities I've had. I can't believe it. I'm just like, I was a girl from Cleveland. I didn't know anybody. And like, I can't believe it. Oh. You know, I really had such a great time, you know?
Oh, it's such an inspiration. It's
showbiz is fun. I mean, it's hard. It's a hustle and stuff, but it's also exhilarating.
I mean, that is so great. And I mean, with all the Nepo baby discourse, to be like a kid from Cleveland and then boom on Saturday Night Live, that's like, that's the dream.
Exactly. Yeah, Lorne Michaels is so great because he'll really pick people who, he doesn't care what Hollywood thinks. He just does his own thing. He trusts his own instincts, and he is just one of a kind. And so I'm so grateful to Lorne, you know? Yeah. And everyone.
And I got to say, I've interviewed a bunch of people. You're so lovely and positive and fantastic, not jaded by Hollywood at all. How did you do it? Because not everyone is like this.
I guess it's because I did work. I didn't have an easy time. You know, I just was like a regular. I worked in restaurants for a long time. I was a hostess at Cravings. I was a waitress at Mel and Rose's. I worked in the evenings and the daytimes at Mel and Rose's baking company. Mm-hmm. I used to temp and I would work for agents as like, I'd get called in like, go into CAA today or go into ICM or go into this agency. And I would just answer the phones.
Wow.
And I just did all those kind of jobs. So I was always driving around LA looking for like help wanted signs.
Yeah.
And filling out applications and going broke and going to the bank and being like, how much money do I have in my account? Like standing in line. And I would want her to whisper because there was always like negative funds. Yes. I was like, don't say it so loud. Yeah. You know, so I think I just... I always think about working and how hard it is to make a living. And I just am, I really, things did not come easily to catch my first break. So I think I really appreciate it, you know?
That is so important. And it's you can feel the appreciation and the warmth through a computer screen.
And what I was going to say too, Chris, and I said this in my book, was that I feel like it's not, there isn't like some getting there point where, okay, now I'm here and I'm happy. That's really not true. It's about being creative, being artistic, working with people you like, even if it's just one or two people, and feeling like they see you, you see them. It could just be one person that you click with. And sometimes it is only one. But what I want to say is that just... having that kind of creative life is such a great thing. Just enjoying it, enjoying the pursuit of something is fun. There's so much meaning in that. So I think it was that I saw a lot of people who had gone to high school with or college moving back home and not really kind of giving up on their dreams. And I was proud that I stuck it out and was still pursuing it. And I was like, well, this is a good life. At least I'm doing what I'm going for, what I want, following my heart and my passions. And that's a good life, you know?
That does it for today's episode. We'll be back on Thursday. Find us in the meantime at Vanity Fair, on Twitter and Instagram at VF Awards Insider, and on our own. I'm Katie Rich, and David
Canfield 97.
And Chris.
Chris Triss.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
From PRX.